Andrew Thomas, press conference.
Well, good afternoon. You know who I am. I just flew in this morning from Adelaide. I've got a couple of days here on a visit that's sponsored by the Institution of Engineers and the Royal Aeronautical Society to come and share some experiences of my flight into space last May. As you know, I had the opportunity to fly on STS-77, which was the 77th shuttle flight on board the Space Shuttle Endeavour. It was the 11th flight of the Orbiter Endeavour. And we launched on May the 19th at 6:30 in the morning and completed 160 orbits of the Earth over a 10-day period, myself and five other colleagues. It was a six-person crew, and then landed at the Kennedy Space Center. It was my first space flight. I hope not my last, and I'm confident it won't be my last, although I don't know when the next one will be. And my role was mission specialist number one, which is, in this flight, was payload commander. And that means that I had responsibility for all the hardware and all the satellites that we deployed, as well as all the scientific experiments that we carried on board. And there were three major payloads that we carried on this flight. The first was a laboratory module called Space Hab, which is just a contraction of Space Habitation Module. And that was a module that's carried out in the cargo bay and connected with a tunnel through into the mid-deck area of the orbiter. So it gives you a lot of extra living space and working space. In fact, it nearly doubles your habitable volume. In that facility, we carried 12 experiments that were looking at the effect of microgravity, which is weightlessness, on various physical and biological processes. Another payload that we carried was a satellite which we deployed and free flew, and which carried an experiment designed to prove that you could inflate large structures on orbit, or create large structures on orbit through an inflation principle by basically deploying something balloon-like and inflating with a gas in space. And we inflated this huge 30-meter long structure and showed that technology works very well. We also had another series of experiments that we carried in the payload bay. Perhaps the most graphic was another small satellite that we deployed around flight day 3 and tracked for several days, and that was to look at how satellites stabilize themselves in low Earth orbit, subject to some of the very weak forces that exist in low Earth orbit. And needless to say, the flight was a great experience. The payloads operated very successfully. They got a good science return, and the mission, by all accounts, was very successful, and certainly an experience that I'll never forget, and one that I look forward to reliving at some time on another flight. Well, that's, in a nutshell, what I did last May for my summer vacation. So perhaps you'd like to ask some questions about the experience.
Was it a surprise being woken on Mission Day 7 by men at work singing Down Under?
It wasn't entirely a surprise. We did not know beforehand what the wake-up music was going to be. You may not know it, but there's sort of a tradition that the flight controls on the ground come up with music to wake you up each morning, which has some sort of connection to the personal connection to the various people on the crew. So I was expecting at some point there would be something Australian coming up, and I was pretty sure that that was likely to be it, since that's sort of the popular, you know, representation of Australia to many people in the US. So it was kind of nice. And we'd just overflown Australia too after that came on, so it was kind of appropriate.
How many years of training have you been involved?
I was selected for the astronaut program in 1992. And I trained for 1 year, as all astronauts do, in basic training, learning about the orbiter and the shuttle systems and how they all work, going into simulators and operating them. And that lasted a year, but then I was appointed as a member of the astronaut office and awaited a flight assignment, which came in June of 95, and that was for STS-77. So then I spent, well, nearly a year, 10 or 11 months, training specifically for that flight. So All told, there's been quite a number of years of my life put into it.
How old are you now?
44. I just turned 40 when I was selected to be an astronaut.
How do you see the future of the U.S. space program?
I think it's looking good. It's like all federal spending programs in the U.S., it's gone through pretty serious scrutiny and funding reductions because of the problems of the deficit. And I think NASA's done a good job actually of stepping up to that, of dealing with those funding reductions and still maintaining the flight rate. In the coming years, we're going to start building the space station. That will actually start at the end of next year, first element, and it'll take 3 to 5 years to build. That will give us a long-term human presence in space. And then after that, I think you'll see a return to the moon, perhaps a permanent colonization of the moon, certainly in the first decade of the new century. You will see a robotic exploration of Mars, and then ultimately a human flight to Mars, although I think that's a long way away still.
What do you see as Australia's role in those and any other space activities?
Just at this particular time, Australia does not have a formal role in any of those activities, but there is no reason why Australia could not, certainly no technical reason. Australia has the technical capability, the sophisticated technology that is needed, and the sophisticated engineering expertise that's needed to be an active participant in a program like this. So there is no reason why Australia, from that point of view, could not be involved. Australia's got the industrial infrastructure. I mean, it's got all the right elements. So the question is more one of political considerations and funding considerations. And that's a decision that political leadership needs to make as to what direction Australia's future will go. To my way of thinking, the world in the next century is going to be a world of high technology, and the space program will be a key element of that high technology. If any community, any country wishes to be an active member of that world technology community, then they should have sponsored research in sophisticated technical areas, of which the space program is one.
And what sort of lead times are typical when you talk about getting involved in space research and in space activities?
Well, space research is one element of what you could call fundamental research. It's really a sub-element of a bigger program called fundamental research, which always is a long lead time activity. That's the kind of research which animates and excites people, but it's not the kind of research that's going to put a product in the marketplace next year, and it's not supposed to. But it does provide the necessary, it provides education and the necessary engineering skills so that the people who do it can work on the products of next year. They have the creative talent and the expertise to do it. And the space program is just one element of that, and it's something that's going to be a long lead time activity, but it's not something you should ignore, because that is the world of the future.
Several years ago, the materials processing was touted to be the big coming industry in space.
Mm-hmm.
So far, nothing much has happened. Where do you see that at the moment?
Yeah, I wouldn't say nothing much has happened. I would say that probably in the early 80s, some of the materials processing was oversold a little bit, not by NASA, but by some of the investigators. And I think even NASA would admit that. We had material processing on our flight, and we were growing semiconductor crystals of some fairly esoteric materials, and by all accounts, they worked well. The idea being that you can grow better crystals of this material in space, defect-free crystals, which would be good for making integrated circuits, higher-speed integrated circuits. Of course, if you could do that, the applications are boundless. I think what you're actually talking about is not just materials processing in space. It's an area called microgravity research, which is the bigger part of it. And I think that's an important research function if you're going to have a space program, because it tells you how to handle materials in space, how to handle fluids in space, how to handle combustion in space, a very important issue in the case of possible fire. So I think it's an important research activity, and we're going to see a lot more of that once we get the space station going. Another aspect of that kind of research is biological material studies, and I think that's going to be a very rewarding venue of research in the future.
Do you see that being just continuing research, or do you see factories in space?
No, I don't. I mean, it would be really interesting to have factories in space, but I actually don't think we're going to see factories in space because, it's still very expensive to get it up there and get it down. And if when the space research documents the benefits of a low-gravity environment and you get materials which have some useful technical application, then I think the responsibility will be on many investigators to try and reproduce those materials on the ground without going to space. So I don't see manufacturing in space, but I do see research laboratories in space.
You mentioned colonization of the moon.
Hmm.
What does that involve?
Setting up the infrastructure to get us from here to there and back again on a reasonably regular basis. The shuttle could be part of that. You wouldn't take a shuttle to the moon, but the first step and the hardest step of any space flight, no matter where you're going, moon, Jupiter, or wherever, is to get to low Earth orbit. And when you come back, it's to do the reverse, to get back in the atmosphere. Well, the space shuttle does that. It's the ideal venue for doing that. So it could be involved in ferrying up components, say, which would be assembled on orbit, and then would be provide you with your lunar injection. You could go to the moon, and then you could land on the moon and have habitation modules landed ahead of you so that they're there when you get there. And you set up shop and start living and functioning there. I think that'd be really exciting, actually. I think it'd be tremendously exciting. I'd love to see it happen. These guys obviously want me to smile, because every time I smile, it's just like... See? Oh, I think the first decade of the new century, probably 2010, something like that. Because we've still got the space station. We've got to get that on orbit. In fact, some of the elements of the space station could be used for that program. Some of the habitation modules could actually be used as habitation modules on the moon. But that's probably when.
Mm-hmm.
Follow your dreams. There's no reason why you can't. I mean, it takes tenacity. There's a lot of involvement. You don't have to be an astronaut to be involved in it. I mean, there's a lot of opportunities for design and research that people can be involved in. You just need good credentials, which is good education, and perhaps a love of what you do, too. And if you have that, I think you can really do some tremendous things.
Do you think the market for engineers and scientists is now a truly global one?
Yeah, I would think so.
Yeah,
I would think so. Yeah. There's still national restrictions. There's always the problems of visas and work permits and things like that. But, I mean, if you work in the aerospace community in the United States, it's amazing how many people you meet from outside the United States that work from Europe, from India, from Southeast Asia. I mean, from all over the world. Australia.
You attended the University of Adelaide,
is that correct? Yeah, I did my undergraduate there, and then I followed that with a PhD. And when I graduated, I was fortunate enough to be offered a position with Lockheed, the aircraft company manufacturer, in Georgia. And I went there, and that's how I became involved in aerospace and things like that. And after a few years of that, I left Lockheed and went to work at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory, which is a big NASA space research facility in Los Angeles, Pasadena, California, actually. And I worked there for a number of years, and it's from there that I got selected into the astronaut program in 1992.
Do you expect to work on the space station?
Well, it wouldn't surprise me. Everyone's going to be, I think. Most of the flights manifested from 1997, or late 97 on, are shuttle flights. to this carrying the space station elements. So it's inevitable, I think, to be involved in some capacity. I expect to be on the ground for a while. I think I'll not be assigned to another flight for a while, but probably in a couple of years I'll be assigned to one, and it could be a station assembly flight, which would be very interesting.
Do you have any continuing involvement in the SpaceHab experiments after your flight?
No, not a whole lot, because the investigators are really responsible for that, the principal investigators, who we sort of represented and did their bidding for. We have had a number of briefings from some of them about, you know, results to date, but we're not hands-on involved.
What was the best thing about being there?
Well, there were two aspects. One was the view, which was really pretty spectacular, and the other was learning to live on a day-to-day basis in zero gravity. And it's really hard to describe what that's like, because there isn't something you can use in around here as a metaphor for being weightless 24 hours a day, sleeping, eating and drinking weightless all the time. It is just bizarre, and it takes getting used to. It's amazing how much we take for granted the fact that we can put things down on a table. And when you can't do that, and you forget, you've got to Velcro everything down or tie it down with elastic, because it'll float away and it'll be gone. We were forever losing things. It's amazing how easily if you lose things. The first couple of days before we sort of got smart, we were losing things all the time. And so that takes some getting used to. Moving around takes a bit of adjustment too, because, you know, our muscles are made to move us in 1G, so they're quite strong. And in zero gravity, you don't need that strength. And if you use that strength, you can end up moving really quickly, you know, floating down a tunnel. And of course, you've got to stop at the other end. And we were all dinging our heads and banging our heads and getting black and blue running into things until we sort of wised up and we should take it slowly and move gently. But that was a great experience, you know. And if you're coming to my little slideshow, you'll see some of the video of us, you know, sitting on the ceiling eating meals and things like that. It was great fun.
Did you get to see any of the two satellites you deployed, the Spartan and the inflatable antenna, and the other experiment that you did?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We the Spartan with the inflatable antenna, we tracked through its whole motion. I've got some film I'll be showing of that inflation. And then, we went back and re-grappled the Spartan and brought it home. The other one, the satellite test unit, as it's called, is actually still up there. It's going to deorbit next year sometime, they think. But we tracked it for like 3 days, kept 2,000 feet from it, just watching it the whole time. Then we backed away from it.
Do you think inflatable antenna will become a viable
engineering term? Yeah, it is. You can start with something like ours was about the size of this table, a box about the size of this table, and when it unfurled, it was 30 meters long and 15 meters wide. I mean, it was big. The canopy on it was like the size of a tennis court. Now, if you wanted to do that using a mechanical system, you know, that unfolds like an umbrella or something, it'd be a nightmare of complexity and weight. The inflatable's not. It's really good.
And we still have the accuracy that you need.
Oh, you wouldn't want to use it for optical measurements, but for radio measurements, yeah, it does. Yeah.
What happened with the souvenirs that you took up with you, the boomerang?
Oh, yeah. I was really pleased to carry a lot of artifacts. I mean, I carried some personal artifacts from my family, but you know, we flew on Endeavour, which is named after Captain Cook's Endeavour, so the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney let me fly a medallion that Captain Cook had actually carried with him on his voyage in the Pacific, and they also acquired a small fragment of the original Endeavour from the National Trust in Queensland, which I carried with me, which was fun. The South Australian Museum gave me a boomerang to carry to ensure I'd come back. they also gave me a couple of other things. They gave me a piece of wood that was retrieved from the north coast of Australia by the John McDowell Stewart expedition that went across Australia in the 1860s, first transcontinental expedition. And they brought this piece of wood back as a symbol that they'd been there. And I got to carry that, and that was really appropriate because my great-great-grandfather served on that expedition. He was there. And there was also a flint and steel that one of the members of that expedition carried. The Premier of South Australia gave me a set of wings that belonged to Sir Ross and Keith Smith, pilot's wings, that they flew with on their first flight in the Vickers Vimy bomber out to Australia. So that was a very important flight in aviation history, not just for Australia, but in aviation history. And it was nice to have a piece of that along with me. And a school in Sydney actually let me carry a medallion that belonged to Sir Charles Kingsford Smith. So I was able to carry a lot of artifacts that, sort of represented early exploration history in Australia and early aviation history in Australia, and that was nice. I remember at a press conference I described them just as I had to you, and then the press turned to one of my other crew members, all excited, wondering what they would carry, and said, "What are you carrying?" He said, "Well, I'm carrying my son's T-shirt."
Did you have time to ponder as you crossed Australia in about 10 minutes the contrast between you being able to see almost the whole of Australia at one time and these explorers who perhaps even lost their lives trying to explore the continent?
Well, I did think about it because I had these artifacts on board, and I got some pictures of the desert in the Northern Territory and the Northern South Australia. And the country didn't look the way I expected. You know, if you drive through the centre of Australia, you see miles and miles of not much. You know, it's really fairly monotonous. But when you see it from space, it's incredible, the texture and the topography and the colouring that you see of dry salt lakes and vegetation, even though there's not much, there is some, and alluvial fans feeding rivers. There's incredible colouring in the centre of Australia that's striking, plus this red colour. You know, you come across, as we did, across the Indian Ocean, which is this really blue ocean, and it's just striking, this red colour that you see as soon as you get to Australia. And there's no other place in the world like it. If you have no idea where you are, and you look out and see this red, you know immediately it's Australia. And everyone in the astronaut office says, picks Australia like that. It's very distinctive coastlines, and this colouring make it stand out. Then as you go across the centre of Australia, you see all these other features that I just described, the salt beds and the ranges and impact craters, ancient meteor impact craters. There's quite a few of them in the centre of Australia. It's really interesting. I've got a photograph of one. And then you get to the east coast, and it's all this rich, green, lush farmland. I mean, it's really a country of contrasts to look at. It's quite amazing.
It's somewhat depressing to be out in space and see the Earth is so peaceful and so void of conflict.
Yeah, it's a bit misleading, isn't it? It's a bit misleading, yeah.
The social problems that we encounter.
Well, you sort of see hints of things like that. I mean, you can actually see some national borders in some countries because there's rigorous difference in agricultural policies, so you can see national boundaries in some areas, instances. You can see the impact of pollutants, particularly you can see them being generated in one country, say in the Middle East, and going across a host of other countries. You can see fires, and I saw this in the northern part of Australia, you can see fires, and the plume of smoke carries for hundreds of miles. I mean, it's amazing how far it carries. Take it for granted, but it goes for miles. You fly over Brazil, and you look and you see the rainforest is just this green, lush land after you've just gone over some dry regions in the Andes. Then you put a telephoto lens on the camera and look at it, and it's all deforested. I mean, it's all like checkerboard with this slash and burn. You just see these roads, and branching out from these roads, it, just all these felled areas of land. It's scary, actually.
Does it make you angry?
Beg your pardon?
Does it make you angry?
Sad. It's sad. Because that's driven by economics, and, you know. I'm an optimist, though. I mean, I think what will happen is that we do realize in time our mistakes and take steps to correct them. But it's getting awfully close to that time, I think, in some instances.
That trip, what did it mean for you personally?
Oh, something I'd wanted to do for a long time. You know, I'd picked a goal in my life that was important to me, and unfortunately I picked a goal that was extremely hard to get, and very competitive to get it. You have to be, although I'm not a very competitive person. And it was just rewarding to have achieved it, something so difficult.
Mm. How would you recap in a few words just your whole trip? The experience of it?
Oh, just an extraordinary experience which was over all too quickly, you know? Just one breathtaking experience after another.